I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. You've heard of corporate lobbyists and lobbyists for special interest groups like the ACLU or the NRA, but did you know there are college students out there who do this work too? Today we'll meet two of those student lobbyists who strive to make sure the voices and priorities of their fellow classmates are heard by state lawmakers. We'll ask them how they do the job and whether they think they're making a difference. After that, there's nothing like a good piece of fiction to help escape the stress of real life. But a lot of work goes into crafting something that reads as effortless. We'll explore the hidden machinery behind our favorite writing. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Students in Kansas, Missouri have concerns that go well beyond their next exams and life after graduation. These days, some point to soaring tuition rates, concealed weapons on campus, sexual harassment and assault, and state support for higher education. To communicate their concerns, student lobbyists work the hallways in both state capitals. Today, we're going to meet the students who do this important work. Brandon Henderson is this year's lobbying intern for the UMKC chapter of the Associated Students of the University of Missouri. Brandon, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
It's great to be here, Mr. Kraske. Thank you.
Eric Martinez is the chairman of the KU Student Legislative Awareness Board. Eric, good morning to you.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.
So you guys are lobbyists, right? Eric, I mean, that word carries a lot of negative connotations these days, but now that you're doing it, does it seem like it's still a negative word to you?
So no. So lobbyists may have a lot of negative connotations. I know that recently we've been moving towards using the word advocacy, but I don't see lobbyists being used as a bad word at all. I think that we do really important work, and even lobbying, our lobbyists, there are various types of lobbyists. So it's not a negative word at all.
Did you used to look at it as a negative word before you began doing it yourself?
I don't think so. I mean, there are some lobbying groups out there who I think it may strike as a negative connotation, but lobbying is so broad that you can't really generalize it.
Brandon Henderson, how about you?
Oh, I definitely did.
Believe in the
negative connotation, yes. Yeah. When you hear the word lobbying, I think there's kind of an assumption that it's always on behalf of some shady special interest group.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
There's a lot of, you know, dark money, political contributions associated with lobbying. But the type of lobbying that we're doing for students is, it doesn't look like that whatsoever. And so I think I've kind of grown to, you know, I guess like the term lobbying, the way we use it.
You've grown to like it because why? Because you see it as important work. You're representing the interests of a lot of students, right?
Absolutely. I think it's very important that students become comfortable with advocating for themselves to their local lawmakers. And the work that the Associated Students of the University of Missouri does is very important. And I think it's important that students are comfortable with, you know, representing their beliefs.
Yeah. You know, Eric, I'm wondering, what's the big concern that's been on the minds of students that you've tried to bring to the legislators over in the Kansas State House this year?
Well, at the Kansas State House, there's a few things that concern many students on campus, one of the largest being concealed carry.
Yeah.
So I know you discussed this earlier. It's been a topic that we've discussed
absolutely
earlier. And many students are concerned, especially our international students. So we do this event. It's called State Higher Education Day each year, and it's when the Kansas Board of Regents schools come in and lobby on behalf of their schools, and it's an incredible experience because all these six different schools come together and choose these different topics. So this year was concealed carry, and Kansas may look different like Fort Hays, right? So this year we tried to lobby on behalf of institutions choosing whether or not they would like to have concealed carry. it's one of the big issues, like I touched on before. Our international students are disproportionately affected by this because they're not allowed to carry. People know that they're not allowed to carry. So they may be targeted.
They see themselves as more vulnerable then.
That's correct, yes. And we spoke with a lot of legislators, and many of them had not thought about this. And it's incredible to think that these people at our campuses feel this way. I know we've been in various meetings where there have been tears shed because of this topic. A few students have actually transferred out of KU to go to different institutions that don't allow concealed carry.
You know, these concerns about concealed and carry in Kansas, Eric, how do the students communicate those concerns to you? How do you become aware of what the student body is thinking about so you can adequately represent them in the Capitol?
Yeah, absolutely. So as chair of the Student Legislative Awareness Board, we do have open meetings about once a week, and everyone's invited. I know that I'm also the government relations director, so I work with the administration at the Student Senate Administration. We call it SLAB, Student Legislative Awareness Board. But SLAB is pretty open. Anyone can come, voice their concerns, join, help us lobby. So it's a very open process. If you have any concerns, you can come to either the administration, SLAB, and we'll hear those voices.
Before I walk away from Kansas and go to Missouri, do you feel you've had some impact in talking to lawmakers about concealed and carry? Because the law doesn't seem to be shifting, at least this year, changing in any way.
Yeah, so we really do. And we do realize it's a long process, right? So we've been taking this issue to State Higher Education Day for the past couple years. So just taking that issue each and every year, in our eyes, we're moving the needle. So we're educating these legislators, moving the needle forward, and having them realize that this may impact many students in a negative way. So as long as we're there educating these legislators, we do believe that the law may change in the coming years.
Well, Brandon, you just heard the concern on the Kansas side is concealed and carry. That's the message that Eric Martinez has been taking to lawmakers in Topeka. What's been the top issue you've been talking to lawmakers about on the Missouri side?
So one of the very important issues that was recently just kind of concluded in the House is state higher education funding in Missouri. That's something that, you know, impacts every student, you know, from all public universities in Missouri.
And while Governor Greitens came out with his initial budget and said, I want to cut it by 60 or 70 million bucks, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And so we were very worried after that that initial budget request was put out there that that was going to be what was funded for higher education. And so we're very proud of the work that was done in the Missouri House to restore those cuts to higher education funding. It's a very important first step.
So you talked to a lot of lawmakers about that, I gather.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How receptive were they to hearing your message and to hearing it from a student, no less?
Right. The first few days we were down there, I think there was some surprise that, you know, college students were making the trip down to the state capitol, you know, twice a week to meet with them. I remember one time I was meeting with someone. He asked me, "So are you a student reporter? Like, what's going on here?" And I had to explain to him that I'm a registered lobbyist in Missouri, and I come down here twice a week. And I think after that initial surprise, you know, lawmakers are very receptive to listening to students.
Mm-hmm. Are they surprised? Do you think do they give you the access you need to come into the office and actually talk them up?
I think there are some times when, you know, some lawmakers may be busier than others at different points of the day. But I think everyone so far in Missouri has been very receptive to listening to students and listening to their concerns. And whether or not they end up agreeing with ASUM's positions, I think every lawmaker so far has demonstrated they act in good faith and they really care about students, which is very encouraging to see.
Do you think if you weren't there, Brandon, what would be the impact? I mean, would it be a lot easier to allow Governor Greitens' cuts just to go through?
I think if we weren't there, I think lawmakers would lose on a very important perspective when they're implementing policy regarding higher education, and that's the student's perspective.
Yeah.
You know, I think the most powerful thing that ASUM brings to the state capitol isn't necessarily, you know, influence over legislation, but it's just kind of a perspective. When we show up there, we share our story with lawmakers, and they get to hear from students directly.
Right.
you know, what it's like to be on the receiving end of some of their policies. And I think that's a very powerful thing.
So do you hit them up in the hallways? Do you go into their offices? Where do you make your contacts?
All of the above. So every now and then you'll be able to schedule like a one-on-one meeting with lawmakers. Sometimes you'll have to wait for them, you know, after a committee hearing. Other times
you talked them out in the hallways there.
Other times you'll be seeing them walk down the hallway and you'll just flag them down, see if they have 5 minutes to talk. It's really whenever you can get a hold of them.
So you got to make your message pretty short and sweet and concise, right? You can't be dancing around too much.
Because you never know when you'll get on the elevator and you'll see someone you need to talk to, and you have about 15 seconds to get your pitch out. And so it's important to keep it short and sweet.
Eric, you find the same thing in Topeka? Do you got to get to the bottom line pretty quickly?
Yeah, we do. We do find that same thing happening in Topeka. And something that Brandon just mentioned, just having that perspective of the student, I wanted to touch on as well. So many of these legislators haven't been on a campus for many years. Yeah. And our goal is to have students go and kind of give them a perspective that they might not think of. And even in 10 years, campuses can change drastically. So it's something that we have looked at as well. And going back to that original question about those pitches. So I know legislators are busy, right? So when we went, we had to cancel a few meetings, try to arrange different meeting schedules, meet someone outside their office in a committee room. So we do find that we have to have our message concise and to have that message readily available as soon as we see that legislator.
And do you take a squad of students over to Topeka when you go over, Eric? Is that what you do?
Yeah. So each K-Bor institution takes about anywhere from 10 to 15 students. Last year, we took about 18. This year, we had to drop it down to about 14 students. So we take these students, and we have a session where we bring all the students together from all the institutions. It's usually the day before, and train them on how they approach certain individuals or these legislators and get that pitch out.
Do you actually target certain lawmakers each day because you want to reach certain people who are influential to over the bills that you're looking at?
Yeah. So some of the things we do is we look at the chairman and the leadership positions, and we usually target them the hardest.
Smart man. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Exactly. So our student body president, Maddie Womack, met with the governor and the leadership on both Senate and House sides, and the government relations directors from the K-Bor institutions met with the chairman of the of all the different important committees. And then we assigned each student a partner, and their partner and them would meet with different legislators.
So. Are the students typically, when they first start out, are they a little nervous about this, about the idea of going up to the chairman of the Senate Ways and Means Committee and saying, hey, or the Senate Budget Committee, I want to talk to you about higher education?
Yeah, I think so. So one of the things that our students and students across the K-Bor institutions may think is...
You're calling these K-Bor?
K-Bor, Kansas Board of Regents.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yes.
That's a little acronym that you toss around.
Yeah,
here.
I apologize. Yeah. I don't believe I said what it meant. So
sounded like cyborg, you know.
Kind of like that. But so it's something that they have to think twice about. So I know a lot of these individuals are really important high up, so that might be a little bit nerve-wracking. But we do try to have students contact their legislators to have a means to talk to them on an average basis. So
meaning a student goes to the legislator that represents their home district.
Correct. Yes. That's
so there's
correct.
A connection there.
That is correct as well.
Yeah.
We also try to do little mixers. So back in November, we had this mixer where we invited local state legislators and public officials, and we had them come to the Oread and just discuss politics with all these different students.
Did people show up?
They did. Yeah, we had about 12 to 15 legislators that showed up. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning with a pair of student lobbyists who work the hallways in Jefferson City and Topeka to communicate messages about the concerns of the students they represent. Could be about tuition rates, concealed carry on campus, sexual harassment. We're visiting with Brandon Henderson, who lobbies at the Missouri State House, and Eric Martinez, who lobbies over in Topeka. Brandon, how nervous were you the first time you went over there?
I was very nervous the first time I went over there. I've been to the state cap before I started lobbying. I'd been to the state capitol once, and
it's a really big, majestic place, right? The first time you go,
and
through
that was
it.
Just me kind of visiting with my family. And so the first day I got there, it was the same very overwhelming feeling, just like knowing all the history that's taken place in that building and knowing all the work that's done. It's a lot to digest at first.
Were you rehearsing what you were going to say to the lawmakers you met with in your head as you walked up to them?
Mm-hmm. And with ASUM, we were all trained as a group before we started lobbying too, on our platform and who we're talking to and how to approach conversations you have with lawmakers. So I had a bit of training going into that.
Now, you guys don't have lots of dollars sitting around in accounts to pad campaign accounts, which has always been the knock on our state governments these days, that if you want to get access, you got to sort of pay the freight and make a campaign contribution. To what extent has that held you back, Brandon?
I wouldn't say it's held us back at all. I think...
But it makes a difference, though, when you have money, right?
I think for some people, it might factor into their ultimate decision of whether or not they take a meeting with someone. But I think even more powerful than money is a story. And something unique to student lobbyists is, you know, on top of all the work we do at the state capitol, we're students first and foremost. And that perspective is something that lawmakers might not get on a regular day basis when they're working surrounded by, you know, lobbyists and, you know, adults who've been out of school. I think
you guys are a little bit different, a little unique, and maybe that makes you a little more interesting to them.
And that's what I think interests them when we approach them to ask for meetings, is that we're still students and we have that perspective.
Does it make a difference to you not having the kind of money you might need, Eric, to you get the kind of access you want?
Well, I would say that pay-for-play politics is a real thing. But
you've seen it up close and personal.
I wouldn't say I've seen it up close and personal. I did want to mention that as KU being the flagship institution in Kansas, it does touch all 105 counties in Kansas. So I feel like they're a lot more receptive if we go in and tell them, oh, well, in Salina, we have this institution down there, and in different places in Kansas, we like I said, we do reach out to almost every corner of Kansas. So I think the legislators are really receptive of these students coming up there. So I have personally not seen it up close.
And you can't take them to lunch or dinner. You don't have a budget for that, do you?
We do not.
So many lobbyists do. And there's awards given out every month for who are the best-fed lobbyists, best-fed lawmakers in each capital, courtesy of lobbyists. But you can't do that.
No. And like I said, unfortunately, we don't have the means to, but usually we find that they're pretty receptive to us. That'd be great if we did have the budget to take these individuals out to lunch and talk to them over lunch, but unfortunately we do not.
Brandon, you don't have a budget like that either, do you?
No, we do not. And so that's something that the Associated Students of the University of Missouri does not do. We don't give contributions to any lawmakers. I don't think that kind of gets in the way of our work. Eric kind of touched on it too, but, you know, students are kind of different from the other lobbyists that kind of work down there too. Mm-hmm. So there's the group of lobbyists that you hear about all the time, but then there's this kind of like weird group of like students who come down there, you know, on their own time to tell lawmakers, you know, how they're feeling.
Brandon, what other issues have you talked to lawmakers about this year?
One issue that has been gaining traction and we're working on trying to get some meaningful legislation on it passed out of the Missouri General Assembly this year, is mental health crisis that's taking place across college campuses, not just in Missouri, I imagine, but across the United States as well.
A lot of kids struggling with that issue. What do you want to see Missouri do?
So our goal is to have all Missouri public institutions essentially report their compliance with standards set out by the International Association of Counseling Services. So the goal of that would essentially be to have universities in Missouri, public universities, tell their students, here's what we're doing for you in terms of mental health services. And that kind of establishes a benchmark that would help guide other policy discussions going further.
Eric, what else have you been talking to lawmakers about in Topeka?
Yeah, absolutely. In Topeka, so we've been talking about funding. So in the past decade or so, we've seen that tuition has gone up by about $2,000, and the wages have remained the same. So we've seen that more and more students are struggling to pay for tuition. We've also lobbied on the national level and on the national level. So like I said, Government Relations Director, it does work for the administration, the Student Senate Administration. So our administration, a few members of our administration went to Washington, D.C., and in Washington, D.C., we met up with all the other SGA, the Student Government Association's administration, and for the Big 12 conference. So we all got together and decided on the couple issues we wanted to talk about. One of them being was the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, and the second one being DACA. So we also lobby at the national level, and it's something amazing that happens because in the Big 12 conference, there's about 300,000 students. So just these 10 different schools coming together and discussing these and having the same message throughout the 10 schools is something amazing.
Some clout.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you guys leave these experiences? Are you impressed with state government? You more cynical about state government now that you've had a chance to look at it as closely as you have, Brandon? What's been your reaction to it now as you look back at your experience?
Yeah, so going into it, I wasn't exactly sure what state government looked like in terms of functioning on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, now that I go down there, you know, twice a week and I get to see it up close and personal, I think I'm very optimistic about the state of Missouri going forward.
Really? Because?
Primarily just because I know there are a lot of hardworking people down there who genuinely care about improving lives. And getting to work with those people is, you know, the best feeling in the world.
So lawmakers just aren't these selfish, jaded people who are looking out for their own selfish interests, trying to work at the leadership ladders. You see, you've met some good people down
right.
there.
Right. It's not like House of Cards. It's not anything like
just so the world knows, it's not like House of Cards.
No, it's not like TV. No.
Yeah. Eric, how about you?
Yeah. So something that catches everyone's eye is those national headlines. But really what affects people the most is your state legislature. So your state legislature mandates a lot of everyday things that go through. So from what we've seen is that, so everyone's receptive, and we do think that we're moving in the right direction. So these legislators do have they want everyone to succeed, and there's no nefarious kind of plot to take over, or there's no nefarious plot, we think.
So you come away heartened by what you've seen.
Yes. So from what we've spoken to with all the legislators, they really do want to help. They really
do. We'll leave it there. That's Eric Martinez, chairman of the KU Student Legislative Awareness Board. He was joined by Brandon Henderson, this year's lobbying intern for the UMKC chapter of the Associated Students of the University of Missouri. I'm glad to hear what you guys said about state government, because I've always found it to be that way, too. There's a lot more good eggs down there than maybe some of the ones who aren't so much. Yeah. Appreciate your time very much. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk to a great writer about writing. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we discussed the possibilities of a Trump effect on the U.S. Supreme Court, and we found out what that might look like. You can hear that conversation in all of our previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday, we'll listen back to a panel discussion KCUR hosted this week about the events in Kansas City following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in April of 1968. Well, it's one thing to appreciate good writing. It's another thing altogether to slap words on a page and hope their combination yields something anywhere close to a work that resembles art. Margot Livesey has been described as one of the finest teachers of writing anywhere, and she lays out her wisdom in a new book, The Hidden Machinery, Essays on Writing, that tackles everything from the impact of the personal lives of writers on the work they do, to the importance of reading to learn the craft, to how character, plot, and imagery all work together. Margot Livesey is the author of 8 novels, including 2017's Mercury, as well as a collection of stories. She was born in Scotland. She's a professor of fiction at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and she joins us this morning from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. And Margot, so nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. This is a pleasure. Thank you.
You know, I've been writing professionally as a journalist for my entire career, and yet I got to tell you, I look at the idea of writing a novel, and it absolutely buckles my knees because it strikes me as so incredibly difficult. You've been doing it for years. Is it still difficult?
It is still difficult. In fact, I think it may be getting more difficult, which is a little bit worrying. But on the positive side, it does remain perpetually interesting.
In what way?
I think the way in which trying to write a novel connects me with the world, makes me look at people differently, makes me explore situations I might not otherwise explore.
How does it make you look at people differently?
I think it makes me... It makes me not take anyone for granted. When I'm writing a novel, I'm always thinking, everyone has a story, everyone has a secret sorrow. You just can't judge by appearances and by superficial interactions.
What's the hardest part of the job of writing a novel, at least for you?
I think the hardest part for me remains finding that intersection between my private preoccupations, my private interests and neuroses and fears, and something that will be publicly interesting that I feel I can reasonably hope other people might want to read and get pleasure from.
Margot Lizzi is my guest. You know, you begin The Hidden Machinery, your new book on writing, by quoting Robert Louis Stevenson, who compares life to art and concludes that they are two very different things and that no art can compete with real life. What did you take away from Robert Louis Stevenson's observation there?
I think there's a lot of confusion among young writers and maybe among older writers too about the project of realism, the nature of realism. When we're reading something like Harry Potter or Ursula Le Guin, we tend to feel comfortably that we're in another world. Mm-hmm. And when we're reading something more realistic, I think we're often a little confused as to exactly how it maps onto our world and how closely characters mirror what people actually do in real life. And anyone who's transcribed a telephone call or an interview knows how differently characters in books talk from people in real life.
You know, you say in here that when you were in your 20s, you made the mistake of failing to connect the novels you loved to your own writing life. What exactly was your failure there?
Like most readers, or like most happy readers, I fell into the novels I loved. I forgot that I was reading. All I wanted was to find out what would happen between Dorothea and Casaubon, or, you know, whether Sonny's brother in Sonny's Blues would rescue him. I wasn't thinking about how the writers had made these books, and it wasn't until I started to reread them trying to think in a more writerly way that I began to figure that out. My reading at university, reading to write critical essays, didn't help me with that project.
So you actually go through books and you try to analyze how writers did what they did. And I'm told that results in a lot of coffee marks on your books and a lot of markings all over the place.
Have you been going through my library? Yes. I mean, I don't often go through entire novels, but I'll read something and be filled with admiration, and then I'll go back and look at, you know, say Jesmyn Ward's Sing Unburied Sing and see, well, how did she start off the novel? How did she tell us what sort of book we were reading, what we should be looking for?
There are so many decisions that a writer has to make. That's what I think maybe might be as daunting as anything, right? You have so many choices to make and decisions to come down on to put something together here.
And I think that's something, again, that people don't tend to realize when they're reading for pleasure. It's a bit like, I don't know, watching Serena Williams at Wimbledon. She's playing beautifully, but any thought that you could go on the court and play like her is absurd.
But people think that about books a lot of times. They read a good book and they think, oh, I could do that.
And I sit next to many of those people on public transport.
Who say, I'm going to write a book myself, right? People say that all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Give us an example of what you've learned by reading the master writers.
I think a good example for me would be reading side by side Henry James's Portrait of a Lady, his first great novel, his first fat novel, mm-hmm. as he wrote to his brother, and E.M. Forster's Passage to India. In Portrait of a Lady, Henry James's project is very clear. Isabel is going to be a heroine. She is going to be riding in the coach throughout the novel, and we're going to follow her to her destination. And in Passage to India, the project is much less clear. There's nobody really riding in the coach. We're offered different characters, Adela and Aziz and Ronnie and people in the sort of British colony in India are offered to us for consideration and conflict. And we can't follow the same through line. What we get is a different kind of complexity. But there are no heroes in Forster.
Margot Livesey is my guest. Her new book, The Hidden Machinery, Essays on Writing, and she'll be discussing her book at the Kansas City Public Library's Central Library at 6:30 in the evening on Tuesday. For more information, go to kclibrary.org. You know, one of those big decisions that I'm sure comes up over and over and over again in the writing of any novel is how much information, how much detail to include about any one character, any one plot line, to give the writer, the reader, enough of a sense as to what's going on here, how much to put in. How do you manage that?
With difficulty, and indeed, my early novels, you know, I had done suitcases of research, and so I wanted to unpack those suitcases mm-hmm. in the novel. I mean, I wanted to put in everything I had learned about roofing and beekeeping and banking, to name three topics that appear in early novels. And it was painful to learn that actually I could only put in a few things about beekeeping. Hmm. So it's a constant process for me of negotiation. But I think what I try to find are the right details, the telling details, and hope that the reader will feel convinced of my authority and understand that I know far, far more than I'm telling her.
Hey, how did you figure out that you couldn't put in everything you had learned?
Other people told me, sometimes not very nicely.
Margot, you're going on a little bit too long here.
Exactly. Well, this is beautiful, but oddly dull.
But you need people like that, though, right? And those people can be a little bit hard to find sometimes, people you trust to give you the kind of feedback you need.
That's very true, Steve. And I think one of the things about many of the great 19th century novelists is that they were relatively solitary in their writing. And it's a great pleasure to discover that Flaubert had a devoted friend who came every weekend to read over the pages he had written mm-hmm. when he was working on Madame Bovary and to critique them for him. And I feel very lucky that in my life I have the wonderful story writer and novelist Andrea Barrett, who makes gladiatorial pronouncements about my work.
Tell me that most of our great writers had people like that. Certainly, we aren't reading classics today that were kicked out just by one person working alone in an upstairs office, writing books out longhand, and that became the final product that was this great classic.
And I think that's a really common myth, you know, Jane Austen writing
right.
behind the parlor door.
Right.
Whoopee, she steps out with Pride and Prejudice. But in fact, she wrote an early version of Pride and Prejudice that was rejected, and it wasn't till more than a decade later that the finished novel was finally published. And over again, we find the journey from desk to publication is more complicated than we expect.
Well, did Jane Austen have somebody looking over her work?
She, as far as I can tell, did not. Her family, it hurts. I know her family knew, but then her work would get rejected, so that would steer her in various directions, in new directions.
Again, our guest, Margot Livesey. If you want to join our conversation with questions about the writing process, 816-235-2888 is our number. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. If you can't call today, again, you can see Margot at 6:30 Tuesday evening at the Kansas City Public Library's Central Branch. More information, kclibrary.org. You know, in your book, you talk about a whole series of techniques that master writers use. Tell us about an author like Toni Morrison who uses her voice to propel her work.
I think Morrison is really among our great writers. I heard her speak at Harvard a couple of years ago, and it was completely thrilling to hear her do with her voice in person what she does with her voice on the page. And I think one of the things that makes her such a great writer is how fearless she is in her use of metaphors, of language, of showing us the world we thought we knew from some very new and surprising angle. And that's, you know, one of her great gifts to American letters over the last half century.
Another author, Tim O'Brien, relies on what you call anti-fiction. What do you mean by that?
Well, in Tim O'Brien's best-known book, which I think we would agree is The Things They Carried, he makes this very cunning testimony to, he dedicates this book to the members of the platoon. He has a character, a narrator, who's called Tim the Writer. Tim the Writer has a daughter. He will tell us how very, very hard it is to tell a true war story and how you have to make many attempts to tell a true war story. He sort of breaks down the normal boundaries between author and narrator and allows us to think that his characters really experience the things he's describing. And I think that's wonderful for the reader, and I think it's a very cunning sleight of hand that some of the stories probably are true and many are invented or embellished or enhanced in various ways.
You know, Shakespeare is known for his social characterization, meaning
that many young writers begin stories or novels by saying, you know, Emily never saw anyone, or Veronica was alone in a room. And that never happens in Shakespeare. Everybody is always a member of society. And even his outcasts, like the fool in King Lear, say, are members of society. No one's ever alone in Shakespeare. And soliloquies are unusual moments in his plays. They occur quite seldom. And everybody exists. The king exists in relation to his lords and his ladies and his commoners, and the commoners exist in relationship to each other, and so on. And I find it very fascinating because I think often we don't, as writers, recognize that we're creating not just a character but a society.
Whitney Terrell, one of our great writers here in Kansas City, has written in to he wants me to ask you about your essay on paying homage in fiction.
Whitney is a wonderful writer.
Yes, he is.
I've learned a great deal from him about social characterization. I got interested in paying homage when I found myself doing it. I wrote a novel called The Flight of Gemma Hardy, which is a writing back, if you will, to Charlotte Bronte's 1847 novel, Jane Eyre. And I had never expected to do this. It seemed presumptuous to write in the shadow of a masterpiece and to make something that was very hard anyway, namely writing a novel, even harder. But I found myself irresistibly drawn to the idea of trying to think, what would it be like if in 1960 Scotland, a girl at the age of 10 finds herself with no family and no money and has to make her way in the world? And it felt like irresistible material. I think I love writing about orphans, like many writers.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on with Margot Livesey. Good morning.
Morning, Margot. The question is common for writers like yourself. Do you write in longhand or on a computer? And such others questions, do you write mornings or afternoons? And what is your schedule for writing? I'll take your answer off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the good call, Frank.
I try to write for a few hours every morning. I was trying to write before I bicycled to the radio station. I nowadays mostly write on a computer, but I try to resist the Mephistophelian bargain that the computer offers. Which is that it invites you always to look at your opening paragraph one more time.
Mm.
And suddenly to think that sentence about the umbrella is dreadful, and I will just fix it before I go to page 17, where I left off the day before and where I should really be working.
You find yourself toggling back to the beginning and messing with it more than where you need to be in to make the progress you want to make.
Exactly. I find myself trying to over-perfect the beginning rather than using my energy to push the material forward.
You know, you've said of your own work that you struggle to get beyond hair color and eye color in your characters. What's your concern there?
Well, growing up in Scotland at the time I did, in the place I did, virtually everyone had brown hair and blue eyes. So those cannot really be said to be informative details about characters. And yet, nonetheless, I keep using them for character after character. And I think they're just place markers for the things I really need to let you know about the character. I need to let you know what they're afraid of, what they're interested in, what they want, what they dread.
Mm-hmm. Along those same lines, the telling detail, how important is it?
I think it's absolutely vital, and I think one thing that distinguishes great writers from less great writers is their gift for detail, their gift for finding that thing that will make the character walk off the page and into your imagination.
Is there an example of a telling detail to give our listeners a sense of that you always fall back on with your own students that sort of illustrates what you're talking about here?
Gosh, that's such a good question, Steve. clearly, I'm just racking my brains here for a telling detail. I think going back to Sonny's Blues, one of the most telling details in James Baldwin's famous story is how the narrator doesn't believe in Sonny and tells him that his piano playing is just noise.
It says a lot, is the point, right?
It says a great deal about both of them.
The secret psychic life of an author, how does that wind up shaping the work that the author winds up putting out?
I think most authors are very protective of their secret psychic lives because that's what they're writing out of in the deepest way. And we don't want to admit exactly the things that drive our passions. And at the same time, we need to be in touch with them to a certain degree in order to shape our fictions. So I grew up with a very difficult stepmother and also adopted some nearby neighbors, a woman I think of now as my adopted mother or my mother. So I had three mothers, and I think you can see in some of my novels that I'm interested in this question of who's the mother, who's the parent.
You make the point in here, and you've alluded to this earlier in our conversation in talking about your own writing, that few authors over the course of their careers get steadily better. I'm wondering, why is that? Because that's a little bit discouraging, isn't it?
It is discouraging. And of course, you can't begin a story or a novel thinking, oh, this is going to be mediocre and second rate. I mean, that is not helpful. But I think some work turns out to be rehearsals for other work. And we don't know that when we're working on the piece. We only see it later. And there's always, I think, in any artistic project, an element of luck. It's like going to the roulette table one more time. You very seldom win all the time.
You know, I can't do a conversation on writing without asking a companion question on reading, because a lot of people out there think we're doing a whole lot less of reading of books and magazines these days than we used to. Why do you think that is, and how much does that worry a professional writer like yourself?
It is, of course, worrying, and I really don't know how to judge this remark. I'm happily surrounded by students who are all reading widely and lavishly. And my feeling is that people are still reading a lot, though in a much more interrupted way and in many different forms. When I get on an aeroplane, you know, relatively few people are holding books or literary magazines, but quite a lot are reading on laptops or Kindles.
Mm-hmm. You know, you come to us from the famed Iowa Writers Workshop. How often do you come across a student that you think, you know, this kid has got what it takes to become a writer of note in the years to come?
I think it's a difficult question. I have the feeling, I have to confess, really quite frequently with my present students. Many of them are wonderful writers, but I'm also aware that there are other elements that, you know, there's finding the right material, finding the shape for that material, commercial luck, a lot of factors in play. So I don't think I'm always the best judge, though I'm quite often right.
Margot Livesey's new book, The Hidden Machinery, Essays on Writing. Again, you can see and hear her 6:30 Tuesday evening at the downtown Kansas City Public Library. More information, go to kclibrary.org. Margot, what a pleasure it's been to have you. I sure enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you for appreciating how difficult writing is.
And I definitely do that. Thanks again. You can find all of our previous programs online. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date, including yesterday's conversation with Colin Powell's former chief of staff, who had quite a bit to say about our congressional leadership, and not a lot of it was good. On Monday, reflections on events in Kansas City back in April 1968, following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Our theme music today is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.